Questions. Okay. Which questions? Is that that whole problem, or is that the one we were talking about?
No, that's the next problem.
So I heard yes to questions, but then I heard nothing. So I think we still have just one person who, maybe two, I have to check my notes, who have done the requirement of asking a detailed question.
I ask detailed questions every time I ask a question.
Questions that start, how do I work this problem, don't count.
Hi, I just don't get that. Why can't you just count that?
Because I'm mean.
How do we know
if you've got to count?
You have to ask pretty much.
What?
You have to ask, otherwise it won't get recorded.
So you have to like preemptively tell you that it's...
No, you can say afterwards, does this count as my question?
Okay. He doesn't like when you start it off like that. I tried that once. This is my question. So to get detailed.
Okay.
No, wait.
Is there a question?
Yeah, there is. For the first, or for problem 7-1, and you're asked to find the drift velocity.
So,
there weren't any straightforward equations, obviously.
Well, there are some pretty, so the equation of interest, I think, is going to be that the current density is equal to the charge times the number of particles per unit volume times the drift velocity. So what we care about is the number of particles per volume. J is the current density. Well, if you don't like the Greek letters, the current density is just the conductivity, which our book calls G, times the electric field. So to get the number of particles per volume, that's where you're going to use Avogadro's number, right? Because you've got a mass per volume, and you know what mass corresponds to so many particles. So you want to get particles per volume. And we've done that before for the ones we were finding alpha for, the numeric problem for pentane. More questions? Yes?
For number 12, when we cut the, when we cut the circle and the plate,
So the question deals with the last question, which is, I called interesting, I think, in the write-up, or novel, something like that. And it deals with taking a real plate and drilling a hole in it, and then asking how that's going to affect the resistance of that plate to current that's flowing like this. And to actually solve this problem, we'd have to do it on a computer. We'd have to use some sort of numerical method to solve Laplace's equation. So instead, the suggestion is to deal with a simpler problem where we have a hole in an infinite fluid, and that's very similar to what we did in class. So once you've solved this problem without any boundaries, then how do we kind of twist that problem into the real problem? And what they say is that, well, if we just imagine a box around this guy, it doesn't really work because it'll turn out that the voltage won't be constant along this surface. And what it says is that what you want to do for these surfaces is take the average voltage. And what they mean by the average voltage is to, if we call this dimension L, we want to integrate the voltage for various values of y and then divide it by the range of y, which is L. So we have formulas for the voltage, which of course we've been calling phi, at any point in space, so we can literally do that integral. Same thing for the current. The current is not going to be exactly perpendicular. But we can get the total current by integrating the current that's in the x direction with respect to y. And once we've got the total current and we've got the total voltage, then we can calculate the resistance by the total the average voltage divided by the current. So this is an approximation, right? It's not truth, but it's probably a pretty excellent approximation. So we have to solve the whole problem, the whole Laplace problem in infinite space. And that gives us the potential, and we go from the potential to the electric field in the usual way, and we go from the electric field to J by multiplying by the conductivity.
So that J is just the J that you find in the
calculation? So this J is the J here at this edge, which is calculated from the electric field at that edge, which is calculated from the voltage at that edge. And the voltage at that edge is the voltage that we got by assuming that there was no edge, that it was infinite space. So this voltage is the average voltage, but this J is the total current, which is what we want, right? We want the total current that's flowing into this thing divided into the voltage. So kind of the overall question with this is, you know, if you drill a hole that it has a radius that is 10% of the size of the Planck, how is that going to change the resistance? Is it going to change it by 10%? Is it going to change it by 1%? So we're looking for some sort of approximation for how much the resistance of that thing will be changed by having a hole drilled in it. So start by solving the infinite problem, which is really very similar to what we did in class, except it's cylindrical as opposed to spherical. And then take that solution and twist it around, calculate the average voltage, calculate the total current, and pretend that those are the right quantities, and calculate the resistance. So we're assuming the electric field that came from the voltage that we calculated by solving Laplace's equation. Right, so those constant potential lines, I'm not sure exactly what they'll look like, but they won't be straight. Because in addition to the term that's like x, that is to say r cosine theta, there's going to be a term that's dipole, right? Cosine theta over r squared. And the rest of the terms are going to be zero, just as they usually are, but we want to actually solve that problem. I don't know, so maybe I should say more, right? So the general solution to Laplace's equation is going to be the sum of all of these sorts of terms, right? We're going to have a to the n rn plus c to the n over r to the n all times cosine n theta. Cosine because the problem is even in angle, so more generally there would be sine terms here. You might worry about logarithm terms. Those imply that there's a net charge on this area, so there's not going to be a logarithm term. And it's going to turn out that we're going to have terms like this for n equals 1 on the inside. Oops, I'm sorry. When we're outside, we're also going to have this term that's needed to make the constant electric field at great distance. And this is really quite similar to what we did for spheres. So the starting point, solve the infinite problem. So if you've solved the infinite problem, come in and we can talk about kind of what to do next. Because you're really there. All you need to do is to do this integral, do these two integrals, and divide, and you'll get the resistance. More questions? Okay, so what did we do last time? We had one important equation that was new, the continuity equation. And that tells us that if we have charge densities that are changing, it's because currents are flowing. If we have currents that are diverging, if there's a divergence of J, then that's going to mean that the charge has to be being reduced inside the volume that the charge is flowing out of. So we're going to be using this equation in its most general form in the future, but for us currently, the situation was that in most conductors, they reach charge equilibrium really quickly, and so the charge density exponentially goes to zero with a time scale that is nanoseconds. So for us, very quickly, we're going to reach equilibrium, and we're going to have the divergence of J being zero, and that leads to Laplace's equation for solving problems where we have a steady flow of current, exactly like the problem we were just discussing. Okay, so solving Laplace's equation is one of the big take-home messages from this whole course. And of course, if we have boundaries, what has to be the case is the charge that's flowing into that boundary has to equal the charge that's flowing out of that boundary. So the normal component of J has to be the same. And of course, we get J's by getting E's and multiplying them by conductivities like G. Okay, so then there was a bunch of stuff which is really old news for people who took electronics and moderately 2 year old news for people who remember their 200 about resistances and Coulomb and Kirchhoff's laws and all of that sort of stuff, which mostly we're not going to be using currently. So this is all going to come back to haunt us when we talk about AC circuits, when we have something more interesting than just resistors to talk about. But for the time being, these, I hope, very familiar results, results that were, for example, in 370. When we have parallel resistances, we have the option of the current going to the left or the right. The total current in has to equal the total current out. And these two resistors have the same voltage drop across them. And work out the consequences of that. And these two resistors act just like an equivalent resistance that satisfies this kind of inverse formula. If we have a series circuit, then there's no exit ramp. So exactly the same current that goes through R1 has to go through R2. And the voltage drop across the whole sequence is just the sum of the voltage drops. And the consequence of that is these two resistors act together just like an equivalent resistor that's the sum of the two. Kirchhoff's laws are just restatements of of what we've already said. If we have a junction, the current in has to equal the current out. That's conservation of charge. You can't create or destroy electrons out of no place. And if we add up all the voltage differences in a loop, well, the ending point is the same as the starting point, so the sum of the changes has to add up to zero. Now, the practicality of implementing these in a circuit, like what I'm sure was an exam problem in 200, is, I agree, a little bit complicated. You have to draw the little arrows on the circle, you have to pick some loops, and all of this is arbitrary. You can point the little arrows anywhere you want, you can pick whatever loop you want, but in the end, everyone's going to get the same answers. So, again, we're not actually going to be using this for a while, but I remind you that if the path goes through a battery like this, then that's an upward step in voltage, so we're going to have a plus V in our equation. If we go through our battery from minus to plus, then we're going to have a minus V in our equation. And one way to remember that is whatever you leave the battery with, the sign that you left it with is what the sign should be in the equation. So here we're leaving the battery with the plus terminal, so we want to put a plus in our equation. Here we're leaving the battery at the minus end, so we're going to put a minus in our equation. So if I've put a little arrow in my circuit and I've declared that that is the way that current is flowing, if my path goes with the flow, if I'm paddling downstream, then I've gone down. So I want to have a minus IR in my equation. If I'm paddling upstream, if I'm fighting the current, then I'm going to be going up in altitude, so it's going to be a plus IR. So I know it takes some practice to get back in doing those sorts of problems. And the only way you're going to get practice is if I assign those problems, and I'm not going to assign them until we do some AC circuits, which are a little bit more interesting. Okay, and I remind you of this, what I hoped you would have learned in 200, that is to say, your calculator can solve these resulting equations really easily once you learn how to use it. So n linear equations and n unknowns, almost certainly your calculators are set up to do that. Incidentally, not my calculator, but your calculators have that programming ability built in under this name, row reduced echelon form. So if you go to YouTube's and you type in row reduced echelon form matrix, you can watch somebody show you how to do it for your particular calculator. Put in your calculator name. And if it doesn't work, come and complain. We'll see. So far, people who have complained, I've shown them that the answer is already on YouTube. Okay, questions on any of that? So solving Laplace's equation is one of these forever take-home things from this course. The other forever take-home thing from this course I told you is the R and the R prime stuff. That is to say, when we want to figure out what the source is of an electric or a magnetic field, we have to add up the effect of all of the different sources. And we're going to use R prime to denote the location of a source, and we're going to use R to denote the location where we're trying to find what the field is. And we had analogous but simpler equations for electric fields, but now we've got magnetic fields. This is called Biot-Savart's law, and it's got this unhappy cross product, which makes things a lot more difficult. What we put in here is the source, and just as we might have rho dV or sigma dA or Q for charges, we might have for the source J dV or I'll say KdA or IdL as the corresponding source of the magnetic field. In terms of the effect of magnetic fields, the force, it's a cross product. So on a wire, which is going to be kind of the most common situation, the little bit of force on this little length of wire dL is given by this cross product. If this were a charge particle, then instead of having an IdL, we'd have a charge times velocity. Okay, and here are various options for current that's going through a volume, current that's flowing on the surface, or current that's flowing in a wire. And I guess I remind you that the book is going to use a lowercase j for this, which is, I think, a disaster, at least with my handwriting. Okay. Questions? So it's a matter of, so we could put the vector over the I if we wanted to, because there really is a directionality to a current that's flowing in a wire. But usually we think about currents as being just numbers read off meters. So all this is doing is saying the direction of the wire is what we want to have here. The direction that the current is actually flowing. Questions? Okay, so all we have left to do then is to implement that equation, right? Just as we did for electric fields. Given a particular charge distribution, let's actually do that integral and see what the electric field is under those circumstances. You remember in lots of situations we found a simplifying way of finding electric fields, namely Gauss's law, as opposed to doing that integral. But, and we will here too, but practice is good for the soul. We might as well calculate some magnetic fields directly. So the simplest sort of case is where we have a long wire, an infinitely long wire, that is coincident with the z-axis. And we're interested in the magnetic field that this wire is causing it at any old spot in space. So let's start off with R prime. So So R prime is going to be pointing at all of the possible locations of current, and that has to be on the z-axis, right? So got to have x equals 0, y equals 0, but an arbitrary location on the surface of that wire. For R, this wants to be, for R vector, this wants to be any point in space. But if it's an infinite wire, it might as well be on the z equals 0 plane, right? Because any plane is going to be the same. And it might as well be just along the x-axis, because any other point is going to be equivalent to that by rotation. Okay, so if I can figure out what the magnetic field is along the x-axis, I can just rotate it around to figure out what the magnetic field is at any old spot. So by making those simplifications, right, without loss of generality, I can hopefully simplify the problem. So dl prime, I hope it's clear that's just dz prime, right? Because the current is flowing in the z direction. And maybe I should put a k hat there to indicate that it's going in that direction. Okay, so what is the magnitude of r minus r prime? So that's the magnitude of the vector that is x0 z prime. And that's just the square root of x squared plus z prime squared. Okay, so let's bring the formula back that we're supposed to apply. So the B field is supposed to be mu naught. Mu naught is, again, 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7th. It's an exact constant as opposed to epsilon naught. Divided by 4 pi, and we're supposed to integrate for the length of the wire, and the current is a constant. It might as well come outside of this integral. So we've got k hat dz prime crossed into r minus r prime, which is, oops, this should have been a minus sign, right? X0 minus z prime. And then we're supposed to divide by the length of the vector that connects the point to our observation point cubed. Say again? This I? Is it multiplied by? So here it is here. The current is the source of the magnetic field. So it better be there, right? There's no current, there's no magnetic field. Okay, so off to the races to do this cross product. Right? So, you know, pick your favorite way of doing cross products. I like kind of the determinant way. So the first vector is all in the k-hat direction, and this other vector is kind of in mixed directions. So I get nothing there, I get nothing there, right? So in terms of the x component, there's going to be 0. In terms of the y component, I'm going to get something from that, but not that, right? So I'm going to get x dz prime. In terms of the z direction, I'm going to get nothing. Okay, so the magnetic field is all in the y direction. And let's think about, so let me remind you, I guess, of what the answer is. Remember that the magnetic field is going to satisfy the right-hand rule. When you put your thumb in the direction of the current, the magnetic field is going to twist it around like that. So in terms of kind of a perspective drawing,
thumb in the direction of what?
So you put your thumb in the direction of the current, and then your fingers twist around in the direction of the magnetic field. So here we are at some particular value of x, and we have found that the magnetic field is all going to be in the y direction, which is exactly what it needs to do, because the current is all in the z direction, and if we twist my fingers around, it's going around like that. Okay, so if we had asked what the magnetic field is here, it would have been in the minus x direction. It's going around in circles. So the reason to kind of avoid, we probably could have done it in this particular case in cylindrical coordinates, but it's a little bit dangerous to do that because the unit vectors aren't constants. They point in different directions at different spots, and so they don't come outside of integrals typically. And to actually integrate them is usually a mess. So really Cartesian coordinates, if we have any hope, is the best bet for actually doing these integrals. Or just be real careful to remember that the unit vectors are not constant. They're pointing in different directions at different spots. Okay? So all that's left to do then is to integrate this. This is a vector, so in general we'd have to integrate three different quantities in order to get the answer. But the numerator has zeros in the x and y direction, so in fact all we need to do is to find the magnetic field in the y direction. So we've got mu naught I divided by 4 pi, and we've got the numerator is just going to have an x dz prime, and we've got a square root of x squared plus z prime squared cubed. And all of this is in the y direction. Okay, so far so good. So, I don't know what we remember from our calculus of long ago, but Dwight 200.3, and you'll find this book in the 200.03. You'll find this book in the library, and this integral occurs consistently enough that you probably want to write it down. And that is that the integral of dx divided by the square root of x squared plus a squared. And let me call that quantity in the denominator r, just so I have kind of a shorthand for it. It's going to be 1 over a squared, and then x divided by r. Oops, this is cubed. This is exactly the integral that we want. A little bit louder? This x is a constant here, but here we're integrating with respect to x. So, I mean, the first thing we need to do is to transcribe Dwight, which is in which the variable we're changing is x, to z prime. There was another question. Get something that's pointier. Okay, so what we got here then is x is playing the role of a, right? It's the constant. Z is playing the role of x. This x here, of course, as you said, can come outside of the integral. And so what we're going to get is by is equal to mu naught I divided by 4 pi. Bring the x out, and then the antiderivative is 1 over a squared, and a is x. And then we have z prime divided by the square root of x squared plus z prime squared. And we need to evaluate that between z prime equals minus infinity to z prime equals plus infinity. I didn't like the purple any. Say again? I didn't like the purple any better than I liked the blue.
You're purple for less, right?
Yeah. Right? I'm going to use black. No. All of these are pretty dull. Green. Green for spring. Looks like it's pointy. We can hope for the best. So, I don't know if the mathematicians have spoiled you so you're not so you're afraid to plug in infinity into things, but be bold. Infinity over infinity often is one. And it, if you think about just taking the limit, I mean, let z be 6 times 10 to the 23rd, right? So whether you have a meter added to that or not is not going to make any difference. So if you really want to make Chris happy, you can take the limit as z goes to infinity. You could probably use L'Hopital's rule, but not me. So minus, so I'm going to put in minus infinity and divide it by the basically the absolute value of minus infinity, and I'm going to get minus 1, right? So after all is said and done, I'm just going to get a 2 from that result. Okay, so what we've got then is the magnetic field in the y direction is mu naught I divided by 4 pi. One of those x's cancels out, and then we've got a 2. So we're going to get mu naught I divided by 2 pi x. Now we can what we have found is that, as we've said before, the magnetic field here on the x-axis is in the y direction. But if we generalize this, really what's happening is the magnetic field is in the phi direction. It's going around. And it's equal to mu naught I divided by 2 pi times our distance from the axis. Right? X is just the distance that we are from the corresponding thing. Right? So the magnetic field is actually going around in the phi direction. Okay? Okay, so on to more complicated examples. Maybe not super complicated to start. So let's do basically the same problem, but instead of having a wire, let's have a shell. So here I have a conducting shell, and it's going to be infinite even though I'm showing a top. And I'm going to have the current flowing through this shell. Now you might remember that kind of the equivalent thing that we had for electric fields is we figured out what the electric field was out for a point particle, 1 over r squared, and then we figured out what the electric field was for a sphere. It was still 1 over r squared when we were outside the sphere, but it was 0 on the inside. And it turns out it's exactly how this is going to work out too. The electric field outside of the shell, excuse me, the magnetic field outside of the shell is going to be given by the same formula, and inside the shell, the magnetic field is going to be 0. But we're going to prove all of that. We're not just going to assume it. Okay, so what we have here is a situation where we have a little bit of area on the surface of this thing, and what we know we're supposed to use for the corresponding source is whatever that surface current is times a little bit of area. And for a cylinder, that little bit of area is going to be r d theta going around and dz prime going up. And of course, this current is all in the k hat direction. It's all in the z direction. Okay, so again, that's the thing that's going to go into our overall equation, Biot-Savart. So instead of an IDL, we're going to have a KDA, and we're going to happily integrate away. So it might be smart at this point to talk about the total current. How much total current is going around in the circumference? So I hope you remember that J was the current per area. K is the current per length, right? Just going down a dimension. It's the amount of current that's going through any line that we have here. So to get the total current, all we need to do is to multiply K times the total circumference of that cylinder. Okay. So we might as well do what we did before for R, right, we, without loss of generality, we can still have R being just on the x-axis. But R prime is now going to have to be more complicated, right? Because it's not going to be on the z-axis, it's going to be on the surface of a cylinder. So we can point at the positions inside of a cylinder of radius R by using our angles, cosine theta and sine theta. And of course, this thing might have some altitude, z prime, also. Okay. Yeah, I think
it.
This, yeah, that's an x. Right, because it's just like we were before. We're on the x-axis. And I don't know if I'll be able to restrain myself from my usual abbreviation of calling cosine theta C and sine theta S. We'll see if I can restrain myself. Probably not. So what we need is the difference vector R minus R prime. So it's pretty easy, right? We just subtract these vectors. So it's going to be X minus RC. I couldn't restrain myself. RS and minus Z prime. That way I can fit it on a line, right? Otherwise it would take multiple lines. The magnitude of that vector. So I need this squared plus that squared. And if we kind of look a little bit ahead, when we square this term and we combine it with that term, we're going to get an R squared. We're going to get an X squared, and we're going to get a cross term to go along for the ride. So I hope it's clear that what we're going to get is X squared minus 2RXC plus R squared plus Z prime squared. Are we believers? Okay, so it's pretty much the same story, right? We're supposed to take, for B, we're supposed to take mu naught divided by 4 pi, integrate up the surface current that's all in the z direction, crossed into R minus R prime, and then we're supposed to divide that by the magnitude of R minus R prime cubed. So we got this pesky cross product to do, and all of this thing is in the k-hat direction. So I'm going to pull all of those constants out except the k-hat when I do this cross product in a second. Okay, so if I do the cross product using the usual determinant approach, we got ijk. This vector here only has a k-hat component. This vector here, r minus r prime, is a little bit more complicated. So we've got x minus r cosine theta minus r sine theta and minus z prime. In order to do this cross product. Okay, so there is an x component to this, right? Coming from this backwards term here, and that's going to be plus r sine theta. There is going to be a y component, which is what we expect, right? The other one was all in the y direction. That is going to be x minus r cosine theta. But there's not going to be any z component. This is an I here. A little bit louder. Under the k. Yes, that's a 1. Because this is all in the k-hat direction, which is 0, 0, 1. Okay, so let's put together what we got. What we've got is that the B vector is equal to mu naught divided by 4 pi. And then we have all of these constants that I pulled out of the KDA. So that was the magnitude of the current, capital K, times R, The d theta and the dz prime are the integration stuff, so we'll pull those out at the end. And then we've got this vector that we figured out is in the numerator. That vector is r sine theta, x minus r cosine theta, and 0. And then we've got in the denominator the magnitude of that cubed. Right? So that's going to be x squared minus 2xrc plus r squared plus z prime squared. All of that is going to be cubed. And we have left over a d theta and a dz prime. And I remind you that this current is actually the current divided by the normal current divided by the circumference of that that circle. Are we more or less happy? Say again?
Not with that integral.
Yeah. Yeah, doing the integral doesn't look like much fun, but Dwight will come to our rescue. Who can see that the x component is 0 when I do that integration? So quick zeros are almost always even odd sorts of things, right? Yeah, so this is over the full range of angle, right? From minus pi to pi. So the denominator is even, right? Because cosine's even. But the numerator sine is odd. It's going to go negative when we have negative angles and positive when we have positive angles. So the even oddness is going to kill the x integral. The only angle part in it is this cosine.
Yep.
And so it's going to be even. Sine is an odd function, right? It's the sine of positive angles is positive. The sine of negative angles is negative. And we're integrating over a symmetrical integral from negative values to positive values. So this integral, the x integral, is guaranteed to be 0. So once again, we only have a y component, which is what we're expecting. We're expecting exactly the same answer we got before. But we've got a little bit of work to do, I guess, in the meantime. So by is the only remaining term. And what we've got is these constants, mu naught over 4 pi. I'm going to leave this as k just because it's a little bit faster to write, times r. And then we have the integral from minus pi to pi. And I guess I should also have comment. It's also an integral for z from minus infinity to infinity of x minus rc divided by all of that stuff cubed. In my experience, you almost always want to do the angular integrals first, but not today. Because the z is pretty simple, right? The z is all set up to use the previous result that we have from Dwight, wherever Dwight went to. There's a lot of complications here, but as far as z is concerned, all of this stuff is just a squared. So this is just the integral of the square root of a squared plus z squared cubed. It's just like this. And when z goes plus minus infinity, just as before, we're just going to get a factor of 2. Plus 1 minus 1. So if we carry out that procedure, so this is, again, a constant as far as z integration goes, so it's also going to go along for the ride. Then I have everything that's not z in the denominator. So that's x squared minus 2xrc plus r squared. And notice that it's that quantity squared, so there's no more square root around it. And then we've got a 2 from the z integral. well, this doesn't look like a pleasant integral to do. In the past, when I was using C as my abbreviation, I had a DC, and so these things were polynomials. I don't got that here, right? This is just a D theta. So that really is a cosine that I have to integrate. And if you think about what I'm hoping for a really weird result, right? I'm hoping that this answer is going to be 0 when x is less than r, and it's going to be the answer that I want, right? Mu naught I divided by 2 pi x when x is bigger than r. That's hope, not proved. And that's really weird for integrals, right? Usually integrals have answers, not answers that are this or that, and particularly when this and that are so radically different. So, is there hope? Does Dwight provide an answer for us? And of course, the answer is yes. So if you look at Dwight 859, and I guess I haven't tried these on Mathematica, so I'm not sure about how smart Mathematica is about. Probably not very smart, would be my guess, for these sorts of integrals. My handwriting makes that look like a 4, and I'm hoping it's a 4. Yes, it is a 4. So what Dwight says is that the integral from minus pi to pi of a minus b cosine theta divided by a squared minus 2ab cosine theta plus b squared is equal to an if statement. It's equal to 2 pi over a if a is bigger than b, and it's equal to 0 if a is less than b. So where did this crazy integral come from, right? It's not like, I presume, much that you've seen before. And one big hint is that it doesn't come in the normal spot of Dwight. So if you look at Dwight, it's organized into trigonometric integrals, exponential integrals, logarithm integrals. Those all have their own chapters. This is in a whole separate chapter that is called definite integrals. So if you remember way back to Calculus 1, you talked about indefinite integrals, where you always had to write the plus c or you lost points, and definite integrals where you evaluated between the beginning and the end and the plus c canceled and you had an answer. And of course, Dwight, like everyone else except calculus teachers, never bothers to write the plus c for his indefinite integrals because everyone learned that in Calculus 1. But these definite integrals are not gotten by that process. That is to say, no one knows what the antiderivative is of this function and then plugged in this and that. That's not how this thing was done. This section on definite integrals are all special cases, tricks, that produce these results. And the one that I'm pretty sure that you've seen before is the standard trick that the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus alpha x squared dx is the square root of pi divided by alpha, if I remembered it correctly. Did you do that last semester in multivariable calculus? It's a real standard problem to do. If so, no one's claiming so. No one ever knew this before? This is usually called the Gaussian integral. I'd be real surprised if you didn't do this. Say again? He never won a Nobel Prize, of course. Let me briefly outline the trick. It's not exactly relevant to us, but the trick was to do this integral twice. To do this integral in x and do it in y, and then shift to polar coordinates where there is an antiderivative. Doesn't sound familiar? Well, do I get to yell at Chris? Who will report to Chris that she's a failure?
Boo.
It's a little bit risky, I agree. Okay, so what I said is that the plan is to write this integral once as the integral, and I'm just going to do it from 0 to infinity this time, of e to the minus, and I'm not going to bother with my, I'll bother with my alpha, it doesn't really matter. So I'm going to write it once like that, but it's of course exactly the same thing if I write it in terms of y, right? What I write is my unknown doesn't matter. So I squared is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity for x and the integral from 0 to infinity to y, e to the minus alpha x squared plus y squared dx dy. And if you think about what that is on the xy plane, it's all of this stuff, right? And so the plan is to go to polar coordinates. So in polar coordinates, the area element is r d theta dr. And in terms of r, I want to integrate theta going from 0 to 90 degrees, and I want r to go from 0 to infinity. Okay, so I squared then is equal to the integral over this area of e to the minus alpha r squared r dr d theta. The theta integral is easy, right? Nothing depends on theta, so that's just going to give us pi over 2. And now we have exactly the antiderivative that we needed, right? The derivative of minus alpha r squared is going to be 2 r dr. So if I put in my alpha r and take away my alpha r, what I've got then is 1 over 2 alpha, the integral of e to the minus u du, and that's one that we all know, I hope. Oops, don't let me drop my pi over 2 that was over there. So this has antiderivative that is minus e to the minus u evaluated from 0 to infinity. And don't drop my pi over 2. So what we've got is pi over 4 alpha, and that gives me a 1. And now you can see that what I get for I is the square root of all of that. So I get the square root of, maybe want my square root bigger, of pi over 4 alpha, which is of course 1/2 the square root of pi over alpha. And the integral I wrote before was symmetric, it went plus minus infinity, so that's where my half came out. Well, that was maybe a waste of time. Did anybody, I'm sure you did this. It's impossible that you didn't do this.
Yeah, well, I didn't have Chris, so that probably explains it.
I'm just picking on Chris. I don't know who taught what. But it's a real standard. It's an integral that plays an important role, particularly in quantum mechanics. So you do need to know this for that. But my main point is that this is a trick. This is not like evaluating in normal integrals. So these things that are in the definite integral section have required some sort of trick. The trick that's involved, so this was one integral. The trick that's involved in the integral we need is actually a different trick. And it comes from a course in complex variables. Did you guys take complex variable? And it goes under the name of residue.
And if we didn't take complex?
I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just saying that this is a reason to take complex variable. I bet. I don't know why I'm selling a math course. As long as Chris doesn't take it, it'll be okay. And I hope you know I don't mean that, right? So, I mean, this is a useful course just as your Fourier course is a useful course to learn how to calculate these integrals, but I bet you probably only spend one day on it or something like that. Residue theorem? You spend a while on it. There are lots of things to learn. And you might have also noticed it earlier in our chapter dealing with Laplace's equation, there was ways of solving Laplace's equation using complex variable. So that stuff does get applied, is I guess what I'm saying. Okay, so that was a long aside. If we go back to the important stuff, to the physics, let me just recopy what we had here. So what we had is the integral we were interested in doing, the magnetic field in the y direction, was mu naught kr divided by 4 pi. And then we were integrating from minus pi to pi of x minus r cosine theta divided by x squared minus 2xr cosine theta plus r squared d theta. And what Dwight told us is that the following integral is true, minus pi to pi of a minus b cosine theta divided by a squared minus 2ab cosine theta plus b squared was equal to 2 pi over a or 0, depending upon whether a was bigger than b or a was less than b. Okay, so I hope it's clear that x matches up with a and b matches up, r matches up with b, right? This is exactly the integral you want. It's kind of rare that you find things that are so nicely matching up like that. And if x is less than r, then that means we're inside the cylinder and there's no magnetic field, right? Which is what I had hoped for. So how about in the other circumstance? So what we've got is mu naught, and let me now plug in that k is equal to the total current divided by the circumference. And this whole integral is equal to 2 pi divided by a, which is x. The 2 for the, oh, I dropped that. Yes, I definitely dropped that. And it was there. Okay, so here I got 4 pi, there I got 4 pi, the r's go away, I'm left with that 2 pi, and I'm going to get mu naught I divided by this 2 pi times x, which is exactly what we got before. Okay. So this is the magnetic field outside of the cylinder is exactly the same as the magnetic field from a wire, and inside the magnetic field is zero. Very similar to what we had for spheres and charges. Well, how about if the current's going around the other way? Then what's going to happen? Right, so what I'm now thinking about is I've got my same old infinite cylinder, but now I'm going to have the current going around the circumference. Right? We call things like this solenoids. And I don't know if you remember your 200 again, but there should be a big magnetic field. Do I have that right? Actually, with the way I do these arrows, it's the other way. Is that true? Yeah, that's true. We have a big magnetic field inside the solenoid. I should have had my purple arrows go the other way, because that's the way they're going to go in a second. There's a big magnetic field inside the solenoid, which is given by mu naught. I'll write it the way it was written in 200, the number of turns per length times the current. Mu naught. But turns per length times current, that's just exactly the same thing as the surface current density, K. And outside, we said that B is equal to zero. So that, I don't know, that's just I'm sure something that you don't remember from 200, but we want to get some expectation about how this thing is going to work. So if you remember our overall strategy, this is how we're going to get these magnetic fields. So the starting point is going to be to figure out which way that current is flowing. And you know, I would erase all of those arrows that are going in the minus theta direction if I could, because obviously I'm going to take my current to go in the plus theta direction. Okay, so just as before, R can be an arbitrary point without loss of generality. It can be in the xy plane because the thing is infinite, and it can be on the x-axis because the x-axis is the same as any place else. We would just twist it around. R prime, just exactly as before, needs to be on the surface of the cylinder, right? So it's going to be R cosine theta, R sine theta, and then some altitude. We have to be a little bit careful now about what before was basically dl, right? So that wants to be a vector that points in the direction that this current is flowing. That is to say, in the theta direction. Right, so instead of idl, we're going to have k, and then the unit vector that's in the theta direction. What is the unit vector that points in the theta direction? Right, so now we're thinking about the xy plane. We have a radius vector that's a radial vector that's outward, and we want this vector here that is pointing in the direction of increasing angle. That's a blunt instrument. So there are lots of ways of getting the answer, and maybe the easiest way is just to write it down. So if you just look at this vector I've drawn, it has a negative x component, and I'm going to try minus sine theta. And it has a positive y component. I'm going to try cosine theta. And of course, it has zero for its z component. And one thing should be the case is that it should be perpendicular to the radial vector. And since the radial vector is cosine sine zero, you do that dot product, you're going to get zero. And it should be perpendicular to the k hat direction. And it certainly is that, because there's nothing there. So that's the angle that the current is flowing in. Another way of getting that, incidentally, would be by taking the derivative of the r vector with respect to theta. Okay, so this thing is going to be k times minus sine theta cosine theta 0. And now we just have to put pieces together, do our cross product, and integrate away. And we should be all set. Well, see how far we get. So what we want to start with is, I'll write it as IDL, but it really is KDA. We want to cross that into R minus R prime. And what we've got is determinant I, j, k. The theta hat direction that we have for this vector, we've said, is minus sine theta cosine theta 0. And r minus r prime, just exactly as before, is x minus rc minus rs and minus c prime. Okay, good to go. So cross product time, we're going to get an I component from that term there. We're going to get a J component from there. And we're going to get a K component from this thing here. Oh, and the other term too. So let's do this one first. So this is going to give us R sine squared, and then when we do this one here, we're going to get minus cosine times x minus RC. And that's going to simplify because cosine squared plus sine squared is r, is 1. So this is going to be cosine minus x, r minus xc. Okay, good to go. So if we look at the big picture again, the B field that we need to calculate, we're going to have mu naught over 4 pi. We're going to have the surface current, which is basically replacing this IDL. We're going to have this vector that we just calculated, minus C Z prime minus S Z prime R minus XC. Then we're going to have our little bit of area element, which is r d theta d z prime. And this all wants to be divided by the magnitude of this vector cubed. So cosine squared plus sine squared is just going to be 1. So we're going to get a z prime squared. And then we're going to get a r squared minus 2xrc plus x squared c squared. I'm not sure I'm happy with that. Well, so let's leave that as it may for the time being. I don't think there's a c squared there, but I can't right now see why there isn't. Say again? I'm hoping to be taking the magnitude of r minus r prime, and you're right, I didn't. So we're going to get this squared, we're going to get the r squared, and we're going to get the cross product. So good. Can everyone see that the x component of this integral is 0? Tell me why.
It's the same thing.
But it's not, right? Because cosine is even. So I agree, this guy is going to be 0 because the sine is odd. But here, it is 0 because it's odd. But not in theta. It's odd in z. Yes. We're integrating both over theta and over z. And we can choose whichever one we want. So this is even in theta, but it's odd in z. And z is going plus minus infinity. Okay, so.
Wait, so if it's even, though, we have cosine over cosine, so it's even, right?
So in terms of angle, it's even. But in terms of z, it's odd.
Why?
Because there's a z. Z to the 1 power is odd, right?
Okay.
Plug in negative values for z, you get negative values. Z squared, of course, by itself is even. Okay, so we only have a magnetic field in the z direction, which is sounding hopeful. Mu naught k, let me bring that r out, divided by 4 pi. The z integral is going to be easy, just exactly as it was before. Right? So we're going to be left with a theta integral, which is going to be r minus xc. Remember, what we get out is a squared when we do the z integral. So we're going to get r squared minus 2xrc plus x squared. And we're going to get a 2 from the z integral, and we still have the theta integral to do. Okay, so boy, we're real close to the punchline, but we're also real close to the end of class. So let me at least write down what the hope is, right? So the hope is that if X is less than R, if we're inside the solenoid, we're going to get a big magnetic field, a magnetic field that is in fact equal to mu naught K. If we're outside the solenoid, we're going to get zero. And if you notice, if you compare this integral to the previous one, the only difference is before we had an X here and an R there. And now those two are switched around. So before we got a non-zero value when this term was bigger than that term, and we still do, right? So this is exactly that same integral is going to be exactly what we need in order to get the result we want. And maybe I will just call it quits. Okay, so we've integrated three different things to find what magnetic fields are.